And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Patty Quatro, what an extraordinary last episode talking about this horrendous, scary mob tale that you told us about. And I've been playing this scary scenario over and over in my head because I have a few pickup questions for you. So, first of all, hello, welcome back.
Welcome. Thank you.
So one of the things I want to just clarify for myself and for the listeners was on the last episode when we were talking about this mob incident, and for those who didn't hear it, please go back and listen, that we had also, you and I had briefly touched upon this story in season two. And one of the things that you talked about in season two that you didn't bring up in the last episode was that when these mob punks started to get a little out of hand and Leo Fenn, your manager, understood what was happening in this club, the guys were drinking, it was just getting a little too close to home, if you will. You had said that Leo told Susie, your sister, to play off being sick, to be this like great actress so that you guys could get out of hanging with these mob punks. You were told to flirt and act like everything was fine. So how did it come together that Susie played sick? I'm curious about that.
Well, she had a younger look to herself. She was like the youngest one. And I think Leo just felt she should be the one to do it. I mean, you know, she was the front singer and whatever. And that's what he decided on. And she did it beautifully. She played like she wasn't really feeling well. And we would party the next night. And we got the hell out of town. You know, we did. But she brought it off and they bought it. They bought it.
Well, that's the thing, is they bought it, because that was my other question for you. But you didn't, well, to clarify, you didn't really leave that night because you had to go back the next morning to the club, which is where you saw everything. But when Leo said to you, and Susie has played sick, you know, oh, we'll see you tomorrow, you say to the mob punks, you go back to the hotel. The other thing you said, Patty, that I really want you to touch upon, because of course now we know the outcome. We know you're okay. We know Leo turns out to be okay. But you said that Leo Fenn hung back. You girls went to the hotel. He hung back. So basically not to raise any alarm bells, like, you know, everything was completely copacetic. But you had said on the previous episode that when he stayed back, that all of you at the hotel were really scared and frightened because you didn't know what was going to happen to him. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about this interim period of not knowing with Leo being gone.
Let me clarify it a bit too, because when he got to us in between sets, he didn't really go into it to scare us horribly. He just wanted us to do this maneuver and get out of the club. He was old enough to know better that, how much he was going to tell us. He knew we were impressionable and whatever. So I think he stayed purposely to hang with Charlie, our mob friend, and listen, and the bar owner, and then he could keep sussing it out. And these mob guys were so damn stupid, and they weren't drunk enough yet that they realized what he was doing. They didn't ask a lot of questions. They didn't even ask where our hotel was or anything. So Leo just didn't want to make them more suspicious. And if he hung out and just, went through the end of the night, that was very smart of him. And yeah, we were scared back at the hotel. We were waiting on him and stuff. It didn't take too long because it was near the end of the night. So he got back and everything was okay with him. We were very relieved to see that.
Well, it really just remains an incredible story. I just think it's phenomenal. And yet, as you have said, it's so on par for the music biz and the mob during this period of time. And
Yeah.
you just brought up Mob Charlie as my new little nickname for him. Now, this is a newer friend of yours, friend in air quotes, that who became a fan. He was definitely in the mob. You had said he had a huge crush on Susie, but
Yep.
he was very helpful in terms of mobbing, if
Yes.
that's the right word, and probably did help Leo out during that
Yes.
night and other times. So, to clarify, did you meet him at the gig at Trudy Heller's in New York? Did he follow you to New Jersey? I follow sounds a little too menacing. Meaning, was he a fan? How did Mob Charlie come into your life?
He saw us at Trudy's. That's the first time we met him. And he really was sort of a protector. Like I said before on the previous episode, he was just protective. He never pushed. He never made a play on Susie. He was very respectful, but he was always there because we played New York many times and he always came around. Just a sweetheart,
I love that.
God for
Love that.
Charlie. Yeah.
And I love that we have a picture. Thank you, Patty, for that, of Mom
Yeah.
Charlie and Susie. Susie looks a little frightened, but I think that was just the moment. I don't think she was frightened at
Oh,
all.
she's so tiny next to him. He was a big guy. And he lived in New Jersey with his mother, for God's sakes. He's a mob guy.
Well,
Oh.
and Susie and her little saucer eyes in this picture, there is a bit of a, okay, I'm going to be nice. Well, the other thing that you mentioned that I want to pick up on, because it ties in with Susie and Darlene, who are still very much underage, and you had mentioned that you had to get fake IDs for them to play nightclubs, and that
Yes.
you had mentioned that although you used to be, or your talents were in providing fake IDs for the locals, you couldn't quite take it to the next level. And so
No.
you were supplied by the son of a mobster, these fake IDs. And so I'm curious, was this in Detroit to play? Was it because you were going to New York? How did this now new level fake ID come about?
I think we had to do that because we were going to be touring and, with ABC and all that. We had to have something that was going to pass muster. So my friend down the street, her sister was married to a mob family, and I'm sure probably the connection was through them. It was like $50 per fake ID, and we obtained them, and they worked all the time. They were fine. They worked for us. That's all we needed, just something that looked real legit.
Well, it obviously worked. And the other reason why I want to know about these fake IDs, because you have mentioned this before, and I just now really need to understand this. So we know you've gone to Trudy Heller's in New York. It's your first trip. Joe Glazier at ABC Booking signs you, takes you under his wing personally. Then you came home to Detroit vis-a-vis the New Jersey pit stop for the mob. And then, but as you said, you came home immediately and you were booked with local gigs. And so, and you had also said that this still fell under the domain of your brother, Mickey, Michael Quattro, and also Leo Fenn. And one of these places, you come home now, you're now these break-on-through girls from the Big Apple coming home to your hometown, and you play the famous Rooster Tail. And it may not be famous for some who don't know about it, but here in Detroit, it is very famous. It's on the Detroit River, it's part of the riverfront, and it's still thriving today. But for the pleasure seekers, Patty, tell us about the Rooster Tail. For those who know that wonderful picture of all of you on the stairwell, that's you at the Rooster Tail. So tell us about the Rooster Tail and how this gig came about.
Rooster Tail was a very big, important nightclub in Detroit, as you said, on the river. And it had a downstairs room, which was more of a supper club type thing, and then the upstairs, which was the young, hip crowd area. And that's where we played. And the owners, Mickey knew them pretty darn well. He had played so many society things, and they were from that Grosse Pointe sort of snotty elite, but he knew them. He got along with them. He knew how to, chat with them and stay in good. So he got us booked in there. And I think we must have played there maybe three or four times. And that was where I think Susie started jumping on a table or a box or something because the crowd was tall and they were dancing in front of us and nobody could see her. She was so little. So, that's where all that came to be. And it was just a really cool place to play. We loved it.
Well, one of the things that you have mentioned before, and I need you to clarify this for me. So you have your fake IDs now, and you're now playing at these adult clubs because you need those IDs. Explain the need for Susie to have to don a blonde wig. And I believe this was at the Rooster Tail. So was this because the fake ID showed her as a blonde? I'm just curious where, or did she want to be
Oh.
a blonde? How did this happen?
No. Oh my God, that's another thing that's in the rock ether. For the life of me, I can't remember why she was picked to be the one to wear a blonde wig because Darlene was underage too. But for some reason, maybe because of her youthful appearance, I mean, what was she, 17 or something when we got
16.
back? 16, yeah. Right on the cusp of turning 17, but she had to do the blip. Somebody suggested that she had to wear the wig to really even fake out with the Rooster Tail people. I'm not sure we even told them that she was underage. We'd had the fake ID and all that. We wanted to play there, so somehow that came to be the momentum that put her in the blonde wig, the stupid blonde wig. We laughed our asses off. But they were strict about the ID, so I think that's what we thought we had to do.
Well, and I will say, just in terms of image-wise, Susie's out front. She
Yeah.
does look a lot younger than the rest of you, even though she's not that much younger. And it's probably because of her height as well. So I was just curious how this blonde persona, this wig came about that she donned. So
That's
at
pretty
this
funny.
gig at the Rooster Tail, you are playing with Paul Revere and the Raiders. Now, Patty, you had mentioned that you had played with them previously, you hung with them before, but I'm curious, did you play with them at this gig? Did you go to see them? Did they come to see you? How did this combo come about?
They didn't. I think they were playing in town and they came to the supper club area and then came up to hear us. They were not on a bill with us at that particular Rooster Tail gig, but we had played with them before. Okay, so they were there and we went down in between the sets from the young hipper area, which what they would have preferred to be. The Rooster Tail people wanted to show them off downstairs in the supper club. So you have those pictures of us. We're chatting with them and we kept coming down between the sets and then they came up to see us. It was a lovely evening. They're great guys. We had a lot of fun with them and the night went that way.
Oh, I love that. And so this is also the moment if they're coming to watch you play, and you said your sister Susie is jumping on tables and now she's wearing a blonde wig, and all of these wonderful shenanigans are happening. So this is where she starts to jump on the table, as you said, and is this where she becomes Susie Soul, quote unquote?
Yes, it's somewhere in right here where she glommed onto that top hat because she got cheered at when she jumped on the table or wherever, whatever it was, a box or something. You can see in the pictures she's above. And it looks like a box to me, something Leo did. She was so little, you know, she looked like a little kid. And it worked. And that did become a huge part of her persona. And I mean, eventually, it didn't take long before we were saying Susie Soul and the Pleasure Seekers. It was all in that little time period.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, I do understand it, but I'm curious. Susie Soul is fantastic, but you were Patty Pleasure. There was Eileen was Lady Godiva. Your sister Arlene was Foxy Lady, and Dar Thumper is Darlene. So, how come the other nicknames for you didn't quite take off in the same way? How did Susie become Susie Soul, and none of you became that same? I don't know. I'm curious.
You know, we all sang. It went around the band. I had quite a few songs. So did Darlene. Eileen had, you know, quite a bit. But Susie took the brunt of the popular ones with the lower register and the soul and the funky ones. And slowly she became more of the front person. She just did. And it happened very organically. It's not like we said, oh, you're going to be Susie Soul now. It just sort of happened. And press would write about the band. You know, maybe she got a couple extra lines. Somebody noted her. I don't know. But it just felt like it was very natural that she got picked out at some point.
Did that ever bring any friction to the rest of?
No. None, none. We were loving that we had, you know, this little front persona that could even get noticed. I mean, it was fine. There was no jealousy. We didn't care. We all still got to sing and everything, but she was just getting a little bit noticed. So, knowing Susie's psyche, you know, I've said she would go to the fridge and open the door and the light go on and she'd take a bow. You know, five kid family, she wanted to be somebody. You know, that was Susie's psyche. Look where it got her. So she was determined to make herself noticed, and she did.
She did. I'm reminded of the nickname that your father, Art Quattro, had for Susie when she was little. And it was Susie Sausage. And she was not really thrilled with that nickname. I don't know anybody who would be, to be honest. But look at her. She went from Susie Sausage to now Susie Soul and garnering that attention. So I definitely see the psychology you're talking about. And she, you know, she's totally talented, as are all of you. So she deserves that acclaim as well.
Yes, definitely.
So another venue that I really want to pick up that you started to play at this time, I believe, it's a very famous venue. Another is the Chessmate. Now, I thought this was in Detroit, but it's not. So tell us about the Chessmate. And this is now still 1967. It's still spring, where this is before summer. And you play or you go to see, I want you to clarify the story, the Blues Magoos. And you've mentioned them a lot before, Patty, but I really want you to give them their props. But set the stage and by telling us about the Chessmate, because that too is iconic.
Well, as I've said, this was an era of intense exploration among the whole nation, okay? You had your folk music that was sort of still there, but diminishing a little with the heavy rock coming in and all the different areas of the US and the ballrooms, you know, coming in and different clubs, teen clubs and nightclubs. You played where you could, you know, and it was a folk and rock type club. And it was opened in 1963, so it was around. And it was a cultural hub that incubated careers like Joni Mitchell, who played there many times. And this club definitely made an impact on Detroit's music. I mean, you know, I said it, I had started before being radicalized by rock, but remember, I was into the folk stuff first.
That's
That's what
right.
I enjoyed before the homeboys radicalized me into rock. So we didn't play with the Blues Magoos there. We just hung out and went to see them. We loved their music. And they were on the very cusp of the psychedelic type thing. And they had a very big hit with Ain't Got Nothing Yet. That was their big hit. It reached number five. And we hung with them at the Chessmate, and we also would go back to the hotel and hang with them and jam some more. Nan was dating Jeff, the drummer, for quite a while. Whenever they would come to town, they were from the Bronx. and they were called the Trench Coats, and then they changed their name to the Blues Macaws.
Well,
And they
hold on,
actually.
sorry. I just because I in case anybody doesn't remember a few episodes ago, our beloved Nancy Ball, who was the original drummer for the Pleasure Seekers. So that means you had been hanging with the Blues Magoo for quite a couple of years now. So, I'm sorry. So Nan was dating who? Spill the tea.
Jeff, the drummer, and Susie was real close with the bass player. Not romantically, but he had a crush on her and they hung together. You know, it's funny how we always went to the instrument that, of the guy. I was hanging with Mike Esposito, who was the guitarist. So, you know, it's funny, they didn't have that huge, huge mainstream success. They were really talented and good, but and they struggled on for a few years. They made, I don't know, three, four albums, and then the lineup sort of dissipated by 1968. So they had their little spot in the sun, and we were there right at that time when they had their big hit and all that. But things started falling apart, and they come in later, patience. There's a hellacious story at the Gorham Hotel about them later.
Patience, grasshopper. No, I don't want to be.
You never want to be.
I never want to be. But no, we will save that story for when you get back
Yes,
to
when
New
it
York,
happens.
the Gorham Hotel. Yes. Well, another thing that I want to talk about, because you mentioned it before, and now this is the moment it happened. So this is also spring of 1967. A band called The Beatles has now released an album called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And a reminder that you and the Pleasure Seekers were already doing a Motown review set. And this is where you would pass around instruments. And you said everybody at Trudy Heller's was just gobsmacked over this performance. But now you're taking on The Beatles and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and you decide to do the entire album from beginning to end. So tell us how this came about. I mean, how did you even come to choose this album? That's a pretty risky and what's the word? Adventurous decision? I don't know what the word is, because the Beatles were huge in that moment. And so you could have been ridiculed, lambasted, laughed off the stage, but you were so talented. So how did this come about, Patty?
Well, you know, I've always, all my life, I've encapsulated my love and appreciation of the Beatles in the following way. I always said it was like those guys were always saying to the world, "Hey, boys, it's over here now." You know, like challenging the musicians to catch up to all the things they were doing and experimenting with. That was like what they were saying to the world with this new album. And we had come back from New York. We knew the Motown was a special set, and it was so damn popular. We said, "Oh, okay, we need to come up with another set like that," because we were playing so many sets in some of these places. So we decided to take on this album with no, we weren't scared about it. We just, yeah, let's do it, you know? And it was the perfect thing because it was so huge. And we didn't trade instruments on this one. We all took different vocals. Darlene sang, I sang, Susie sang, you know, Eileen sang. But it was what we did with this floored me, what we were able to do. You know how sometimes in a song somebody can change their tonal quality a little bit and affect in an affected way? We did that on this. We would do the Sergeant Pepper and we're Sergeant Pepper's, you know, in a very English sounding voice. And Darlene on Lucy in the Sky, she went almost sort of nasal. You picture yourself. I mean, she affected her voice. And then at the end, the one that floored me the most, we did, you know, that big crescendo in Day in a Life?
Oh, yeah.
We duplicated that. And it was right on the money. It dropped people's jaws. We did the entire crescendo all the way up at the end of Day in a Life. Every instrument. It was incredible. So we pulled it off. You know, we pulled the whole thing off, and it was a favored set.
I wish we had some kind of copy of this, and we don't. But you know what it's making me think of, Patty? I mean, again, you had your epiphany as a 16-year-old seeing the Beatles live at Olympia and said, I'm going to start an all-girl rock and roll band. And now it's not even, it's 3 years later, And you are now the pleasure seekers, having been signed, you're being booked everywhere, and you're now doing an entire set of the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and taking it on, and absolutely
Full
taking
circle, full
full circle.
circle.
But the other thing is, there actually is a word for what you're describing of when artists will change their vocal quality to fit. And it's funny because the first person who comes to mind, and I can't remember the actual word of it, is Paul McCartney. He was famous for changing his vocal quality to fit within a certain style of a song. Joel is another one, obviously he's later, but another person you, Patty, will work with way down the line in the early 70s in Fanny is Nikki Barkley. And she
Yes.
too was very, very good at changing her vocal quality to fit a song.
She
So
did that.
go ahead.
And they would make fun of her on the couple songs she did that on, the original members. It was like, are you freaking nuts?
And
That's
she was,
so cool what she did. You
it was
know,
so
I
cool.
don't get it. It's
I
a
completely
challenge.
agree because she went into the music. She wasn't, her ego was not there. She came
Yeah.
into the music with the, how is this going to fit? And that's what the Pleasure Seekers did when you were
Yes.
still teenagers in 1967, covering at the moment the Beatles, I don't think could have been any bigger. And you take this on and you play that last song. And the other the final thing I will say is you and I opened up this season talking about the incredible harmonies of your sisters, the Quattros. And now you're bringing these harmonies. Granted, Darlene is there and Eileen is there, but you're now bringing these harmonies to life, to an
Yes.
audience with the Beatles.
Yep.
What's that
Yep.
like?
It was amazing. We had so much fun with that set, and it got very popular. We played it a lot in Canada because we started touring Canada more. And oh yeah, we love doing that set.
And I went in.